Navi Pillay is one of the world's most respected legal minds. She grew up in South Africa during the apartheid era, experiencing the racism and exclusion of white minority rule. After becoming a lawyer in 1967, Pillay was the first woman of color to open a legal practice in her home province of KwaZulu-Natal. She became deeply involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, defending activists, exposing torture, and helping political prisoners like Nelson Mandela. In 1995, 1 year into democracy, Mandela made Pillay a High Court judge. She was the first woman of color to serve in South Africa's highest court. In the same year, the UN General Assembly elected Pillay to be a judge on the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. During her 8 years there, she made significant contributions to broaden what legally qualifies as an act of genocide. Pillay later served as a judge in the International Criminal Court at The Hague, until she was appointed to lead the UN's High Commission for Human Rights in 2008. In her 2 terms as commissioner, she worked to expand the scope of the body's anti-discrimination work to include previously unaddressed groups, like migrants and people who face caste-based discrimination. Today, Pillay chairs the Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, an independent body that investigates alleged abuses of international humanitarian law under Israeli occupation. On this episode of The Interview, I'll talk to Navi Pillay about her work and her lifelong journey fighting for human rights. And the chair of that independent commission of inquiry for the occupied Palestinian territory, Navi Pillay, joins us now on The Interview. Ma'am, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for inviting me to talk about this crucial affair.
It is a crucial affair, and it's interesting that the commission of inquiry, for somebody who doesn't know, they might think that this was set up after October the 7th. Just to lay the foundation a little bit, I'm curious to know the circumstances within which it was set up in 2021 and how things might have changed over the past year since October the 7th and the aftermath.
Well, first, we all know this is a 70-year struggle, so we always bear in mind the historical background and conflicts. There have been many conflicts, but this commission was set up on the 21st of May, 2021. It has a very wide territorial and jurisdictional mandate. It's there set up by the Human Rights Council to investigate in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel. So we can investigate inside Israel as well, all alleged violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. And you're quite right, Imran, this was set up long before October 7th. When October 7th, 2022 happened, we stopped our planned work and investigated that incident as well.
Why has it been so controversial to many people when you say October the 7th, 2023 didn't happen in a vacuum and that there's a context to it? Why did you face so much backlash? Why do you think so?
Because the war now waged against Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied Palestinian territory and the spillover into Lebanon is all being justified because of the October 7th attack by Hamas and Palestinian armed groups. And therefore, we continually put in the historical background. I myself, as High Commissioner for Human Rights, supervise the hundreds of reports relating to the violations under occupation. So we have to see it in this context, not just October 7th and the retaliation thereafter.
For those who believe this is a genocide, I mean, even if people don't go to that extent and they're not so sure, it is clearly massacre upon massacre. And for many, they're seeing it happen in real time in front of the cameras in Gaza particularly. How does this differ from other conflicts and other such situations of utter carnage, especially from a powerful military against innocent civilians. How does it differ for you, given your vast experience, given that this is happening in real time, and there's so much evidence that emerges right in front of us? Does it even help your team in collecting evidence?
It's very difficult to be investigating in the midst of conflict, number one, and secondly, without the cooperation of the host government. We've made like 20 or 25 requests to Israel, and they're just silent about letting us in to investigate. That is a challenge, but it has not put off the team, my brave team that is working on these matters day and night. It's helpful that so much of the atrocities are being filmed and videoed and put on social media by many people, including the Israeli Defense Force or Israeli security forces, I should say. It's terrible, obviously, for the victims, but it's useful for investigation that we have access to that material. Let me say the difference you asked about the difference, Imran, is that, you know, I've never come across a situation where a government is actually acting in defiance of international law. You must cooperate and work with the United Nations, not against the United Nations, and definitely not attacking the United Nations officials. So all this is very, very chilling for me.
And does it then call into question the efficacy of the UN? As somebody who's been in the system for a long, long time, especially when you were UN human rights chief, does it call into question whether the UN is fit for purpose? Not only because the Israelis can continue to do whatever they want to do, but also because of the protection from the United States and the ultimate power that lies in the veto power in the UN Security Council.
It's a very faulty system, but that's the best we have, the United Nations. It's very, very important that we support multilateralism. This was an institution created after World War II to ensure peace and security in the world. I feel positive, Imran, because of the massive support that our commission has received from member states. It's true there are strong opponents on behalf of Israel from the United States, the UK, and quite a few European states. But overall, our recommendation to the UN General Assembly in 2020, that was before the...
That was your first, yeah, so that was, what was that, 2022, yes. Your initial report, right? I know the U.S. Right. State Department had sort of dismissed it. So there was talk to me about that initial report, and then talk to me about your report a few months ago to the General Assembly. Talk to me about how would you characterize the reaction to those two reports?
Well, firstly, the establishment of the commission, the resolution establishing our commission was opposed. I was very surprised by the United States. I expect Israel to oppose it. They always have, but the United States and some European states. And I asked them the question, why wouldn't you support a referral to your own court, the International Court of Justice, for an opinion? The resolution establishing this commission was opposed on very spurious grounds, that it's permanent and doesn't have a date ending it. And I was able to point out to the representative of the United States in the Human Rights Council that actually there are two other commissions and inquiries that do not have an end date, but were supported by the US and these opposing states. So a great deal of double standards, I would say, and taking sides. And you should not be taking sides. Everyone should be on the side of compliance with international law, and especially international human rights law. However, these opponents did not win, and I feel comforted that almost 87 states voted to ask for the ICJ legal opinion, because we identified that the root cause of the conflict is that the occupation is unlawful.
Just as a small opportunity to educate myself, what are those other two commissions of inquiry that don't have an end date?
The one was on Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, these are those III mechanisms that were set up, I think, on Iraq.
I see.
They don't have an end date. They were supported and funded to the maximum, whereas we are struggling for funds. And of course, coming from South Africa, where we experience so much sabotage in liberatory work in South Africa, I can see that withholding funding is one of the ways in which they intend to ensure that we do not function. So I'm very happy. So I feel positive, mainly because of the hardworking team of just about 14 or 15 people who investigate, under the direction of Chris Sederti and myself, the commissioners.
So you have this powerful Goliath trying to make things a little bit difficult for you, withholding funding, not giving you the best opportunity to fulfill your mandate. At the same time, and you've mentioned South Africa, and of course, as we know, you are a high court judge in South Africa. You were actively involved in the liberation struggle against apartheid. South Africa came in and decided to take this to the ICJ. As somebody who was an ICC judge, somebody who was an ICJ judge with a special tribunal for Rwanda, some people tend to downplay it, nothing will happen, nothing good can come of it, this is just posturing. And other people seem to think that this might actually get the war to end and that this is crucial. South Africa's intervention at the International Court of Justice, joined by others, is a massive step. Where do you land on this? Because you're the best person to ask.
Imran, it's a massive step. And we are the ones, the commission, who motivated it. We set out all the facts on the ground. We set out the law, set out that it's a 70-year-old conflict. Our mandate requires us to identify the root cause of the conflict. And therefore, I welcome not only the resolution requiring an ICJ opinion, which they've delivered, but the application by South Africa. I'm very proud of the South African lawyers who were able to get the provisional measures under the Genocide Convention. These are very, very serious. And these are steps that states should have taken a long time ago. I had nothing to do with it, but I'm very happy that South Africa had the courage to bring that application.
Do you believe that Israel is plausibly committing genocide?
Well, you know, I'm called the genocide judge. I delivered the world's first genocide judgment in the Rwanda tribunal. A lot of the law comes in, Imran. It's very tricky. You have to prove an intention to commit genocide. You don't establish it just by pointing to the large numbers of killings, death, and destruction. All that helps. But you have to establish the intention, which in the Rwanda genocide, we looked at statements made by the political leaders. And we looked at policy, a direct intention to destroy the Tutsi population. This is what South Africa has to establish. But it seems to me, and I agree with many, many people who see it this way, they're halfway there. Because they were able to convince the court to grant provisional measures under the Genocide Convention on the premises that there is plausible reasons to suspect that genocide is being committed. I see that as half winning.
So we have the catastrophic situation on the ground, ongoing slaughter of people. We have statements, quotes from the defense chief, national security chief, the finance minister, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, and all of those, Netanyahu himself. So you say they're halfway there. Okay, in terms of, forget intention for a second, in terms of the actual destruction on the ground, when we look at crimes such as, or what can be termed war crimes and the like, is that abundantly clear to you that those are being committed? Or if crimes are being committed, which ones are clear to you? That are sort of not even up for debate that have been committed, especially over the past year?
You know, we've set this out in our report. So we said there's ample evidence to prove that war crimes are being committed, crimes against humanity, violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. And so these include crimes of extermination, intentionally directing attack against civilians and civilian objects, murder or willful killing, using starvation as a method of war, forcible transfer, gender persecution, targeting Palestinian men and boys, sexual and gender-based violence amounting to torture, and cruel or inhuman treatment. So every one of these is backed by the evidence that we found.
And you have a UN, so you have a UN Commission of Inquiry listing that litany of abuses, yet we still can't get to a ceasefire. So I'm going back to that question. How is the UN fit for purpose when we still can't get the killing to stop? We can't even get a pause on it.
I'm very much with you as a civilian. But as I said, I'm not here to defend the United Nations. I serve here under the mantle of the law and international law. I, in my life experience, found that the law always triumphs. The law triumphs over force. So at some point, they have to get back to the law, even those wielding the veto in the United Nations. Let me recall to all our viewers that when it came to apartheid South Africa, the United States and UK, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, used the veto to stop sanctions against the apartheid government. Later, they were persuaded to change their veto. And that's what gives me hope, that eventually they will be convinced by pressure from other states and by their own population demanding that their governments respect international law. So there has to be a change in the way the veto is being politically used at the moment. I'm very much part of the reform movement, and even as High Commissioner for Human Rights called for reform of the Security Council and this veto system.
Are we in the midst of that persuasion happening right now of the United States and maybe some of the other European countries where their support, particularly for Netanyahu's government, might not be unequivocal anymore? Do you feel that that's happening?
I wish I could, like Palestinians who are at the receiving end of incredible loss of lives, damage, and so on. I can understand from their point of view. There doesn't look like any immediate change in the policies of powerful governments who are supplying the weapons to Israel to change course. I do believe that reports such as ours, which are United Nations investigations, verified factual accounts of what's happening, and which we deliver to the Human Rights Council in Geneva and to the UN General Assembly every year, will tip the balance to convince states to stand up even more strongly against the use of the veto when it comes to humanitarian critical situations. So we take the complaints to the Security Council and we say, you know, you can't possibly use a veto in this situation. We're getting there to push for that kind of reform. You know, I myself, we saw no hope under apartheid, 300 years of apartheid, but we never gave up. Everybody was involved in some way. And that's the way we feel towards Palestinians. They also, with the 70-year-old struggle, we will continue to oppose the use of the veto. When complaints are, factual complaints of humanitarian violations are placed before these veto-wielding countries.
Yeah, for some living in the early 80s, they might have found it very hard to believe that someday Reagan and Thatcher might actually decide the tide is turning, we need to do something different. And that's a really good point. Good historical point that you've made, gives us some sense of perspective. I want to ask you, you were shaped and molded as a judge. some of your highest profile positions were as a judge. This work is a bit different. It's advocacy. It's advocacy and something different. You don't get to make that final judgment. Does it frustrate you then sometimes that you lay out the evidence, you lay out the story, but you don't have control on what happens after that?
Imran, you're quite right. You know, I was the first woman of color to be appointed a judge by President Nelson Mandela, and then he nominated me to the GA, and I became an international judge. And that's what I'm trained to do, to be independent, impartial, look at the facts. I will never let down the trust that he placed in me in being very fair. However, then I became High Commissioner for Human Rights, and that, you're quite right to point out, is advocacy, not judgmental. Every High Commissioner for Human Rights will tell you that it is frustrating because the main violators of human rights law are states themselves, yet they are the duty bearers to deliver and protect human rights. I get some of that when I sit here now as chair of this commission of inquiry. My mandate is to investigate fairly, bring facts to the ground in the name of the United Nations. We get the full support of the entire UN mechanism and all the agencies when we come up with these reports. So I should think there is a certain judicial element in the way we approach an analysis of the facts and verification of the facts. It is advocacy, but it's very important work. And therefore, I readily agreed to undertake this work.
I believe my judicial training
actually enhances
right.
this work and provides some respect for the commission's standing.
And your judicial training no doubt gave you a very thick skin in passing judgment. You probably faced a lot of backlash sometimes from, I don't know, people who have been sentenced. For those who have been condemned for crimes. The criticism, especially when it gets personal, does it hurt you? Does it affect you? I just did a Google search. There's an international law weekend coming up. You were invited by a law firm. 37 pro-Israel organizations put out a petition. They associate your name with being anti-Israel, with being anti-Semitic, and so on and so forth. When you come across that, does it sting? Does it hurt?
No, it does not. You know, I understand fully these are lobby groups. They are not disputing the content of our report, the facts that we have found. So they have to find some ways of saying it's all lies or to attack the commissioners personally. It doesn't affect me. I will continue with the work because I am satisfied that I am not anti-Semitic. And I'm not doing this for awards anyway. But the incident you mentioned, the International Law Association, in fact, already gave me the award last year, despite the objections of certain lobby groups.
Okay. I ask this a lot of my guests in trying to find some hope amid genocide, carnage, desperation. Who are the good guys out there? Who are the peacemakers? Who are the role models to make the world a better place?
There are many of us. Apartheid didn't end in South Africa because one or two persons spoke up. We all did. So we all have a responsibility to speak up about any violations, violence. And in this particular case, Palestinians have been silenced. They're unable to take their voices themselves or to take action. I think the collective action by civil society across the globe is what's needed here.
Do you think the occupation will end in your lifetime?
I certainly do. I used to answer that question, do I think apartheid will end in my lifetime? Would you believe, Imran? I used to say, no, I don't see any hope of apartheid ending in my lifetime. Well, there you are. You know, I've lived now like 25 years after apartheid ended. We still have many problems, but we empathize so closely with the Palestinians because they were struggling for their liberation at the same time as South Africa. That is some of our background on respect for the rights of freedom for everyone. And this is why it's not a matter of thick skin or being hurt. It's being convinced that you occupy the high moral ground when you speak up against the oppression of people.
Navi Pillay, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for joining us on the interview.
Thank you, Imran.
Take care.
Thank you for having me.